Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has been a successful educational consultant, a devoted activist and researcher on behalf of organ donation organizations, and now a successful novelist. Margaret Verbal felt she had to write fiction about 20 years ago. She began writing novels based on what she calls her convoluted Cherokee family history. Her first novel, Maud's Line, set in eastern Oklahoma in 1928, tells the story of 18-year-old Maud Nail, a headstrong, charismatic protagonist living on her family's allotment with a ne'er-do-well father and a sensitive brother. That first novel would become a finalist for the 2016 Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. Now comes her latest novel, Cherokee America, a sprawling history set two generations earlier in 1875. This features another fictionalized woman from Verbal's family history, Cherokee America Singer, a family matriarch known as Czech, who managed a dying husband, a large family, and even larger extended family through a series of crises, disappearances, and tensions between families and cultures. Margaret Verbal is an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation who grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, but visited her Oklahoma family on every vacation, and it's those long family ties that have inspired her writing. Cherokee America is published today from Houghton Mifflin, and there'll be a launch party this evening at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Margaret Verbal, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this character, Cherokee America Singer, who is the protagonist in your new novel, Cherokee America. Where did this character come from?
She came, she's based on a real person, Cherokee America Rogers, whose headstone I discovered in a graveyard. It's one of the most substantial headstones in that graveyard, and I was there visiting my grandfather's grave and saw it, and I was attracted to it because it was beautiful. It's black marble and didn't look like much of anything else in that cemetery. So I went over and I looked at it, and then I saw the name, Cherokee America Rogers, and I thought, wow, what a fabulous name.
That's a name for a book, isn't
that's
it?
That's a name. Yeah, well, I wasn't thinking about a book at the time, but I thought, what a fabulous name. And my family is related to the Rogers, who produced a lot of notable people, including Will Rogers. So, I was interested in that also. So I went home that night to my grandmother's house down in the Arkansas River bottoms, right outside of Fort Gibson, and told her that I had seen that gravestone. And what a fabulous name it was, and she laughed, and she said, "You found Aunt Czech." And I said, "Do you know her?" And she said, "Yes," and then she told me this story about how Mrs. Rogers had taken in my grandmother's father and uncle, and they were orphans of the Civil War, and she really, gave them a life. And my grandmother was very fond of this woman, and who had been dead for a long time by the time I heard about her. So then every time that I visited my grandfather in that cemetery, which is now the Citizen Cemetery outside of Fort Gibson, but was originally the Cherokee Nation Cemetery, I went over and visited that grave. And so I formed an attachment to her, and assumed, because my grandmother called her Aunt Czech, that she was blood kin to us. But when I started researching her, I found that we had no blood kin at all.
I assume you began learning about her life at some point.
Well, I learned as much as I could about her life. I started researching this before the internet and before people were doing, all the wonderful things that they're doing now. And so I never did, learn a terrible lot about her. I know from my relatives who knew her son, Connell Rogers, and had cut potatoes for the Rogers. I knew what they knew about them, but I could not find much about Cherokee America. But I did find that she had famous male relatives. That her father was Gideon Morgan, who led the Cherokees against the Creeks at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. Her great-grandfather was John Sevier, the first governor of Tennessee. Her great-uncle was Chief Lowry, who convinced the Eastern Cherokees that they ought to listen to this guy with these crazy scribbles because he was going to, they would be able to read like white people did. And he sponsored Sequoia to the Eastern Cherokees. And, you know, we all know how that turned out. That turned out real well. And she was first cousin to John Hunt Morgan, who was a Confederate raider up in Kentucky and Tennessee of some note. So the men in her family were written about, but she was not written about.
So when did you decide to write a fictional story about her? You changed the name in your book. It's
right.
Cherokee America Singers,
right.
Not Rogers.
Right.
It's the Singer family instead of the Rogers
right.
family. But virtually all the characters in this book are based on real people
yes.
from Indian Territory about 1875.
That's right. That's right. And the reason I changed the name was that there were two, I discovered in my research, that there were two Rogers, well-known big Rogers families in the Cherokee Nation. And one was the one that we're related to, and one was another even more prominent Rogers family. And I thought, if I just throw in one more Rogers in here, it's just going to confuse it's going to confuse everybody. And she got the name Rogers from marrying a white man. So, you know, I didn't have any compunction about changing that name just to, you know, not confuse people. So I started writing on this book probably about 2001, 2002. I don't have...
So this is a long time ago.
A long time ago.
This was probably fairly shortly after you really began writing seriously, because you
yes.
only started writing seriously about 10 or 15 years ago and didn't show your work to anybody for a
right.
good 10 years,
that's
right?
That's right. That's right. And I wrote one thing before I wrote this, and, you know, the thing that everybody who writes fiction starts, you know, writing about their own life in a fictionalized way, and then they hopefully put it in a drawer somewhere and never see it again. And I did that, but then I started writing on this. And by that time I'd been reading Cherokee history for a long time and had, you know, a background in Cherokee history. So I started writing this, and it's a complex novel. It's not a simple novel, not only in terms of having a lot of characters in it, but in terms of the themes of it. And the interrelatedness of everything, which is a basic Indian way of living. And
can you describe that way of living?
Well, you know, I think that...
I mean, the story is very much a matriarchal story, right?
It is a matriarchal story. It
yeah.
is. But it's also, I mean, the notion of having just a single hero or heroine who rises above everybody else and is brave and wonderful, you know, that is really a Western concept. That's not a Native American concept. Native American concept is that we're all going to try to live in harmony together. And we are who we are because of who we are related to. And that's, to this day, that's very much part of being a Cherokee Indian, and I assume part of being any other kind of a tribe. And so in my opinion, really in order to write about Indians, you have to write about a group of people. You can't just write about a single person. And that's a foreign concept to a lot of white readers and a foreign concept to a lot of people in New York
yes.
who buy books. So that, but I felt that it was essential that if I was going to write about those Indians, that I had to write about them as a group of people, as a community.
And there is a huge cast of characters. There's Czech, there's Puny, who
yeah.
is a laborer for Czech.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, I can't remember if he was actually a slave at one point or is he always a freeman?
No, he was always a freeman.
Yeah, but he was working for them. He disappears. A horse disappears. All sorts of things disappear.
That's right.
And it's during the course of this story, a baby disappears.
That's right.
And yet, Chek is at the heart of the story, but again, a lot of characters are playing a role in this. And I guess it goes to this, what would be family relationships, but even perhaps even larger, maybe going back to old clan relationships?
Yes. And that's it. You know, who you're aligned with, and I assume this is true of other tribes. You know, I can't speak for all Cherokees or certainly for all Indians, but what I can say is that the alliances, who you're kin to, and, you know, that's important. And that's still important today in Cherokee politics.
Yeah. And telling that story of a clan and how they would react to event, is that what you were trying to get at?
Well,
and I don't want to say clan, because it's really clans are...
Yeah, clans, when you use the word clan in when you're talking about Cherokees, you're talking about a very specific thing. There's seven clans. But, and the clan system was abolished officially in 1820. But what I'm talking about is a community. And if you look, even today, it's strong in the Cherokee Nation. They have a sense of community that you don't find everywhere. And if you don't write about that community, you can't really write about Indians.
Yeah. I want to ask you about yourself, because for the most part, I mean, you spent time in Oklahoma in summers, but you really grew up outside of that community.
I did.
So how did you learn about that community to be able to write about it?
Well, my mother was the only member of her family that left. Everybody else was in Muskogee and
Fort Gibson.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, and she, you know, she married a soldier who was stationed here in World War II, and he took her back to where he was from, back on the other side of the Mississippi River. But, of course, you know, that didn't really suit her entirely, because she kept coming home. So we were out here all the time. I mean, you know, I don't think my poor father had a vacation other than coming to Oklahoma for, you know, the first 2 decades of his life. And so we were here. Our whole family was here. One member of our family was the tribal attorney, Earl Board Pierce. So I knew Earl. And even though we were at a low point in history, because the rolls had not been opened again. The government's notion was that if you will enroll these Indians and then we'll close the rolls, and then after the enrolled ones die, there'll be no more Indians. And, you know, that really, I felt from a very young age, I remember feeling this when I was in my teens, was these people are going to disappear.
Their way of life's under assault.
Their way of life is under assault. They're going to disappear, and this is not right.
I assume coming back, like in summers, you were sort of within it, but you were outside of it too.
Well,
and you could actually see it from a distance.
And I think that that's really important for a writer. It's so difficult to write about something that you're inside all the time. So I was here in the summers. I was here at Thanksgiving. I was here at Christmas. But then I was in Nashville, Tennessee, which is entirely different from the Fort Gibson Bottoms, I'll tell you that.
My guest today is Margaret Verbal. She's the author of Maud's Line, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2016, and her latest novel is just out. It's titled Cherokee America. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you set the book. Maud's Line is set in that time when you're talking about the allotments were given out, and it was an idea of, let's see if we can turn Native Americans, indigenous people, into white America. I mean, that's...
Right, that was the idea.
Steal the land from statehood.
Yeah.
This book is set in the decade after the Civil War, about 10 years after the Civil War. What was important about that time period?
Well, it's set in 1875, specifically in the spring of 1875. And at the time I began writing the book, there had not been a lot of published research on the aftermaths of war in Indian Territory.
Now, I can only think of one book, and that would be not really a book about Cherokees, but it was a book set somewhat in the territory. That's Charles Portis's True Grit. I mean, that's the only book that only strikes me as
that is fiction. Yeah,
of course.
But there hadn't been really a lot of scholarship. And so I learned a lot in doing this. And slowly as I was writing this book, more and more of that scholarship came out. But really what made me set this book in 1875 is that I wanted to tell the story of my great-grandfather and his brother being really saved by this woman. And so I set it at a time that they would have come as boys, as orphans, to Indian Territory to try to find a life somewhere. And that was my starting point. And
they show up pretty early in the book.
And of course, I feel a connection to them because I'm related to them. And they were orphaned by the Civil War. I have another great-grandfather that was orphaned by the Civil War. I have a great-grandmother who's in this book, who she was born in a refugee camp of the Civil War, the Cherokee refugee camp. So this is, the Civil War was devastating to my family, and they weren't even in the South.
Yeah. I mean, it's considered a sideshow in the course of the Civil War, but it was less devastating.
Yeah, it was absolutely, it was as devastating as the Trail of Tears was, because it destroyed everything the Cherokees had built after they had been forced to come out here. And so they had to rebuild it again.
They had a punitive treaty somewhat?
The Treaty of 1866, that's right.
Yeah, that sort of reduced their rights.
Mm-hmm.
Really
took their land.
Yep. Federal authorities were the main source of law based in Arkansas. And so
Judge Parker is in this book.
Yes, he is. And so they're at the mercy of a whole string of people who would come through the territory. They can't really police their own borders.
And they're being invaded by white people.
Yeah.
The whites are the illegal immigrants, and they're having a terrible problem, and they had a terrible problem from the time they got out here. And, of course, they'd had a terrible problem back east with illegal immigration.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you do in the book is you use the Cherokee syllabary when a character speaks in Cherokee, which gives a reader who doesn't know Cherokee it actually gives you a very familiar situation, because if somebody's speaking a foreign language, you don't understand it. You don't know what was said. You can only guess at what they were actually saying. Why make that decision?
Well, I mentioned earlier that the tribal attorney for the Cherokees, Earl, I guess, was a tribal attorney for four decades. And in his law office in Fort Gibson, on the roof were sequoias. Symbols. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely gorgeous. So I fell in love with those symbols, when I was pretty young. And only recently, though, have they become on computers so that you could do that.
Right.
So the language itself, the use of the Cherokee language, is an important part of the plot of the book. And in some places, I have people speaking in Cherokee where the reader needs to know exactly what is said, and I have that in English in italics.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so in love with the syllabary and those symbols that I wanted to throw them in, and we had the technological means to do it. So I asked my publisher if we could do that, and they said, yeah, let's do that. And, of course, it's really important to the Cherokee Nation that we preserve this language. And the nation has put all sorts of resources into preserving the Cherokee language. So, you know, I'm just trying to do my little part.
Yeah. Well, was the reaction from the publisher positive from the get-go? Because I would think an editor would say, yeah, but, you know, you need to put this in italics because people need to understand what's being said.
They had already bought the book when I told them that I'd like to do that. But they loved it. Oh. They absolutely loved it.
Margaret, tell me a little bit about this start of writing, because you came to writing fairly late. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, you wrote for almost a decade before you even showed your first thing. And you didn't start off writing stories. You didn't start off writing vignettes or anything like that. You started off writing novels.
I started off writing novels. I'm naturally a novelist.
Tell me about the decision to start writing. What led you to start writing?
Well, I had been an English teacher when I was first out of college, and I had wanted to become a writer. I married, the guy I married was a poet in residence for the Nashville school system. And so we had sort of literary aspirations, but it's hard to make a living as a writer. I mean, it's almost impossible now, but it was hard then. It's nearly impossible now. And so we got into, you know, trying to support a child and, you know, have a home and stuff like that. And it became obvious that we were going to have to do something other than write. And so we've run a consulting company for 35 years and have been successful at it. But in that time, I did do some writing. I wrote television programs. I wrote scholarly articles, a couple of textbooks, things like that. So it's not that I stopped writing. It's just that I didn't write anything I wanted to write. And so, yeah, I hit sort of midlife, and it's just like my fingers were tingling. It wasn't a decision. It was an absolute compulsion that my fingers led me in. And I just started doing it, and I would work like a dog, you know, all week and come home and write at night or write on the weekends and just keep writing because I just simply had to do it.
Were you showing folks your work?
No.
Well,
my ex-husband, he and I discussed this book, you know, on Friday and Saturday nights when we were both so worn out from work that we couldn't hardly do anything else. And, you know, when I got a draft of it that I thought was presentable, I had some readers read it and then got feedback and then worked on it some more. And I first started trying to get it published in 2004. Hmm. And basically, I got some good responses to it, but as I look at those responses, the pattern of what people were telling me was, you know, basically, I can't sell Indians. I don't know where to sell this book. And it's a pretty Indian book. Now, Indians are in vogue now, you know, and so it gets bought. But for a long time, nobody, you know, you have one or two Native American writers, and then that's the quota. You get one or two Native American writers, and we just don't need any more.
So you set it aside.
But
you kept writing, right?
Well, what happened was that I took it to a novels workshop up in Kenyon College, and I got some very good advice from a woman named Nancy Zafras, who is extraordinarily good writer, wonderful writer. And, you know, she said, look, she said, New York wants, for a first novel, what New York wants is they want a sort of a simple story with one, you know, a heroine or a hero and make it easy and, you know, that's what they're looking for. So I went home and I wrote Maud's Line in 14 months.
Yeah, well, and so, and I assume you got a different reaction when you...
And as soon as I set it out, I got a I mean, the minute I sent it to New York, I got me an agent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I absolutely followed that advice, and Nancy was exactly right about that.
Have you always been just a novel writer? Did you ever mess with stories or things like that?
I've got some short stories. A woman named Roxana Robinson, who is also a fabulous writer and very well known, has mentored me for a long time. And she grew frustrated along with me about getting my novels published. And so she said, now look, why don't you try, most people start with being short story writers, and then they evolve into novels. Do some short stories. And I didn't really want to take that advice, to tell you the truth, because the short story is not my natural form. And so I sort of muddled around for about a year before I took Roxana's advice. And then the first short story I sent out, it got published. So, and then I published, I don't know, 7 or 8 more short stories, but I don't have the fondness for that form that I have for the novel.
But do you think that helped open the door for the novel?
I do. Well, maybe.
You don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think it does for most people. I don't think that's the exact way it happened for me. Mm. But I think it was good advice.
Yeah. Well, you've set Maud's line in 1920s.
1928,
right after the big floods of 27.
Right.
This is set in 1875. Are you going to write about a different period for your next book, or do you know? Have you actually started on a next book?
Well, I'm always writing.
Uh-huh.
I've got a couple of books that I've already written that I don't know if we'll, you know, I don't know what'll happen to those books, but I'm writing on another book right now. But I will mention that the people that are old in Maud's line are young in Cherokee America.
Hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that these novels
are becoming interconnected.
They're tied together, and when I wrote Maud's line, my plot or scheme was to use it to get Cherokee America published. And so if you read Maud's line carefully and know what you're looking for, you'll find just a small paragraph in it that tells you the plot of Cherokee America.
Interesting. All right. Well, the new novel is titled Cherokee America. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Margaret Verbal, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Novelist Margaret Verbal speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her latest novel is titled Cherokee America. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. There'll be a book launch party for the book tonight at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books. That event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.